October, for example, was the classic time for falling out of trees trying to knock acorns down to fatten pigs, because that was the season for fattening up pigs on ripe acorns before you slaughtered them.
That was Stephen Gunn on some of the dangers that face the inhabitants of Tudor England.
It's not a society of equals. It's and I think that's one of the historiographical myths of the Anglo-Saxon period.
And that was Ryan Lavelle on the Anglo-Saxons. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast with me, Rob Attar. This podcast is brought to you by the team behind BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. And we also have digital editions available for the iPad, the Kindle Fire and Google Play. And currently, our Google Play and Kindle Fire editions are only available in the UK, but we do hope to roll them out to other countries soon. Last month, in our Christmas issue, historian Stephen Gunn co-wrote an article about dangerous toys and games in Tudor times. It was based on research he'd undertaken for a major project on accidental death and everyday life in 16th century England. I interviewed Stephen shortly afterwards, and I began by asking him to tell us a bit more about the project.
So this research comes from a project funded by the Economic and Social Research Council, which is running for 4 years, and we're now nearly a year and a half into it. The aim of the project is to look at the 9,000 or so coroner's inquest reports into accidental deaths which survive from 16th century England. So far, we have photographed probably more than three quarters of the reports, and we've classified all the reports from the 1550s. That's the decade we started with, and we're now working on the 1590s with the aim of seeing whether there are significant changes we can pick up between the 1550s pattern of accidents we found and the 1590s one. And the hot news from the first couple of years of the 1590s is that there are a lot more accidents with guns, which suggests that guns are spreading through 16th century England by the end of the century.
For the article you've written for our Christmas issue, we're talking specifically about the death of children. Were there quite a lot of accidental deaths of children recorded here?
About one in six of our accidents seem to happen to children. Quite often the specific age of the child is given. And what we do for statistical purposes there is to break them down into what seems to have been one of the 16th century ways of thinking about people's life cycle. So children from 0 to 6, that they think in sevens, it seems. So children from 0 to 6, children from 7 to 13, and then adolescents from 14 to 21. 21 was the age you came of age as a landowner, and many apprenticeships and so on would have ended around that age. So there seem to be periods of about 7 years at a time. And one of the interesting things that comes out there is that children under seven seem hardly ever to have been working when they had accidents, whereas children between 7 and 13, about a quarter of the accidents they had were while they were at work. So clearly children of a certain age, unless they were wealthy enough to be still in education between 7 and 13, they would be expected quite often to be starting work of some sort.
So even though the thrust of the feature was about dangerous toys and games, in actual fact, a lot of children were dying in the workplace.
Yes, often fairly basic jobs, so carrying things around, often following somebody else carrying something, carrying grain to a mill, for example, or looking after animals, taking horses to water, for example, or feeding horses. The one that surprised us with children working was large numbers of boys driving carts. One of the accidents we found helps to explain how they got into the position of driving those carts, because we've got a 9-year-old boy who's being taught how to drive a cart by his father, who then gets overexcited and runs and jumps onto the cart and then falls off it and is hit by the cart as it falls over.
When we're talking about the very young children, quite a few of them, it seemed, would have died playing or with toys. Were these kind of deaths quite common in those days, like more so, for example, than nowadays?
It's difficult to say because it doesn't always record what the children are doing. We do get insight from the fact that quite often they're described as playing, but quite often they're just described as being by water. Very large proportion of these deaths, particularly of small children, are drownings. And so sometimes the way in which they're playing is described. One child said to be looking at her reflection in a big tub of water. Another child is making mud pies out of mud and then presumably wet mud by a ditch and then falls into a ditch and drowns. But it's not always clear how they're playing, what they're playing at, but at least sometimes they're described as playing. The games that they play are not always easy to reconstruct. So this is one of the areas where the inquest reports don't tell us everything we'd like to know. Obviously, it would be nice to know if they were playing knuckle bones or telling each other nursery rhymes or quite what, but they don't go into detail that they don't need in order to explain how the accident happened.
But even so, I suppose you're getting information from these reports that you probably wouldn't get elsewhere about the way children lived.
Well, that's right, because, of course, lots of the things that children did when they had accidents were things that were unspectacular. So they were things that nobody bothered to record. And you can tell things like where they were they inside their house or were they in the garden yard, say, around the house, or were they actually quite far from their house? Did children have quite a lot of freedom to go around, which... some of them did, particularly as they got older, though a lot of the accidents to small children are either inside the house, particularly very small children, sometimes strapped into chairs to stop them running around, but then those chairs toppling over into the fire. Or they're in a garden or a yard near the house. That's where quite often children are falling into tubs of water or ponds in the back garden or wells or areas of water like that. Or they're playing with animals very close to the house, and then we've got babies, not actually in the 1550s sample, but in other samples, attacked by pigs, but most often the most dangerous horses, as the most dangerous animals, as they were for adults, were horses. So kicks from horses or trampling by horses seems to have been a really major danger for people of all ages in the 16th century. And of course, then the accidents also tell you things like what time of day things happened. They'll tell you which day of the week things happened, which months things happened in. We've recently been doing some work on adult games and recreations, and that's very interesting because it shows you which months people did different sports in. So almost everyone who died playing football was playing football in February, whereas people who died watching throwing competitions, throwing quoits or throwing the sledgehammer, which seems to have been quite a popular summer sport, that they were being killed in June and July, which seems to have been the sport for the month or the 2 months for playing those sports. And people who had accidents with collapsing maypoles, not surprisingly, tended to have them in May or in April when the maypoles had just been put up.
So this can really open a window into leisure activities for adults and children in this period.
It seems to open a window of a different sort from the windows that we've had before, because most information we have about leisure activities, at least before you reach the 19th century when folklorists or whatever you might call them became interested in how children played and what the traditions were of children's recreation and of adults' local recreation and why they were different from different parts of the country. You might think in the 20th century of the Opie's great study into nursery rhymes, for example. Before all that, it's really only possible to know about recreation most of the time, either because it cost money. So occasionally church wardens, for example, might pay to bring greenery into the church at different times of the year, or they might pay money for bonfires for celebrating bonfire night, gunpowder treason day, things like that, or because the authorities were trying to control things. So we know why people thought that dancing around maypoles was a bad idea, because it encouraged young people to get too friendly with each other and produce illegitimate children and so on in the nightmare vision of moral reformers of the 16th and 17th centuries. And we know why, for example, football was thought to be a bad thing, because it stopped men doing their archery practice, which would have been a much more militarily profitable way for people to spend their recreation time. But we only know from that sort of material that it was thought to be a bad thing, that authorities were trying to regulate it, maybe why it was thought to be a bad thing, and sometimes who the people were who were getting into trouble for doing it. What our sort of material tells us is not only, for example, what sort of people were doing archery practice or playing football or throwing the sledgehammer or whatever, but also when and where and with whom and sometimes under what circumstances. So you can show, for example, that sometimes people from adjacent villages would play football matches against each other.
And has anything in your research so far, do you think, will change our understanding of leisure in this period?
I think one of the interesting things is swimming, because the medical advice in the 16th century was mostly that it wasn't very good for you to expose your body to water. It opened the pores and let diseases in. Swimming became more fashionable in the late 16th century, particularly under the impact of people thinking about the classical world, where clearly the Greeks and Romans had done a lot of swimming. So it's interesting that the first book on how to swim in English is written by a Cambridge academic in the 1580s, and you find Cambridge students starting to drown trying to learn to swim in significant numbers in the 1560s and 70s. And we're finding people in our accidents, not all of them scholars or educated people or people who would be thinking, I must swim because the Romans were so manly and they did lots of swimming. But some of them, people like that, we're finding them drowning from the mid-16th century onwards. So we've got a scholar of Eton College who drowns in the 1550s. We've got these Cambridge people in the 1560s and 70s. But we have also got apparently people who aren't studying and presumably haven't read books like that, who are also trying to teach themselves to swim. We've got somebody who's trying to teach himself to swim in the River Severn with inflated bladders that he's holding on to, but then the current is stronger than he thinks and it pulls the bladders away from him, and then he drowns. So it does look as though people were trying to swim and in some ways trying to teach themselves to swim. We've got someone who, it said, actually went to a pool to try to teach himself to swim. But when this first book on how to swim is written, one of the things it says is, if you're trying to learn, take somebody who's a strong swimmer with you in case you get into trouble. And these people who drown are often people who drown alone. So what this goes with also is a sense that at least at the height of the summer in July and August, people, men rather than women, are completely stripping off and going into water to wash after work, because labourers and people travelling a long distance and getting hot seem not to have thought, well, the best medical advice is to stay out of the water, but just to have thought, I'm very hot and sticky and dirty and I'm going to get in the water and have a good wash. And then something goes wrong and they end up drowning.
Coming back to children, in these accident reports, were there any comments about negligence of the parents or guardian?
There don't seem to have been. Occasionally, there's a comment that people didn't know where the child was, say. If people had thought that parents were being negligent, then it looks as though they would have been able to say so, because the format of the reports would have enabled that. But even at times when we might think the parents are being negligent, so for example, there's a boy who takes his friends to play in his father's blacksmith's workshop, and then a hammer and a scythe fall down on top of him, there doesn't seem to be any blame placed on the parents. And in fact, the small boy who is trying to drive the cart and then jumps onto it and turns it over, it actually says that he did it without his father having told him to do it. So there does seem to be a sense this wasn't the father's fault at all, that the boy just suddenly ran off and jumped on the cart. And it's difficult, of course, because the jurors are local people, so it may well be that they don't want to get the parents into any more trouble than they're in already, or that they don't want to cause them grief. But then the jurors themselves could be put under pressure or punishment by the government if it turned out that they'd given an untrue verdict. So we have to put some degree of trust in what the jurors told the coroner at the time.
And what were these reports used for? Were they for prosecutions or anything? Did anything come out of them?
the point of the reporting process was to investigate the cause of death so that it was known whether it was a murder, because if it was a murder, then you'd start a criminal investigation and potentially bring a murderer to justice, or whether it was a suicide, because if it was a suicide, then the goods of the person who'd killed themselves would be forfeited to the crown, to the king or queen, because suicide was regarded as a crime against the king as well as a mortal sin. So the idea was to look at look at all kinds of sudden deaths and decide whether they were murders, whether they were suicides, whether they were accidents, or whether they were in another category, which they called by divine visitation, which just means a sudden death with no obvious cause. And the majority of those verdicts came in for people who, for example, died in prison, where jail fever seems to have gone through prisons very fast. Sometimes there's a terrible case in Oxford in the 1570s where not only do many of the prisoners die, but even the people trying them in court catch the fever from them, and the judges die as well. So there are significant numbers of cases like that. But we do get occasional other cases where people just drop dead in the street for whatever and are not known to have any obvious disease, and therefore it's thought suitable to have a coroner's inquest into it. The problem, of course, again, with the records is that we have no way of investigating all the deaths of that sort that didn't have a surviving coroner's inquest made into them. So it's hard to use these things for calculating absolute rates of death or even absolute rates of accidental death, although we can try to use them for comparing things, as with the point that I was making earlier, that, for example, horses seem to have been involved in far more deaths than any other kind of animals, even other animals which you would think could be quite dangerous, like cattle.
Does your research give you the impression that this was quite a dangerous time to be growing up in?
Well, there were things that don't show up in our records that were much more dangerous than the things that do. So very large numbers of children would have died before they reached the age of five. And a lot of that is just from various kinds of epidemic and endemic disease, particularly because diseases that adults had built up some kind of immunity to, children hadn't built up any immunity to. Children were obviously particularly susceptible to fluctuations in diet caused by bad harvests or problems with drinking water supplies. So we're looking at a society with very large infant and small child mortality, even quite apart from the accidents. And similarly, obviously adults would have died in larger numbers from things like the plague or the sweating sickness or influenza epidemics than they would have done in our accidents. But then the accidents also shed light even on those epidemics. So, for example, what appears to have been the first big influenza epidemic in English history happened in the late 1550s. And it's during that epidemic that we get numbers of reports of people who are in a confused state because they're running such a high fever. And this is used by the jurors as an explanation for why people will try to get water to drink, in particular in irrational ways, and then fall into pits. We have somebody who comes downstairs early in the morning and smashes a hole in the kitchen wall in order to get out of her house, presumably because the front door's locked and she's a servant. So she smashes a hole in the wall to get out into the garden so that she can get some water to drink. Or we've got other people who are in very high fever and collapse at work, and then someone tries to pick them up and take them somewhere to look after them, and then they bang their head on a door. So there are various circumstances in which people have things which are accidents, and so they're classified as accidents in the records, but for which the context is a large epidemic of disease, which we know from other sources, in particular from parish registers, which start in the late 1530s and record the baptisms and the burials in each parish for the places for which they survive. Those parish registers show us the large-scale movements of population, and our accidents are just small pieces within that bigger pattern.
So do you think that because disease was so rife in those days, even if there were quite a lot of accidents, people would be more worried about things like disease than the accidental deaths?
I think people were probably worried about both. It's interesting if you look at pre-Reformation religious practice that people are concerned with sudden death. They're concerned with sudden death partly because they didn't want to die without having made confession of their sins to a priest. And so it was said, for example, that there were certain prayers that you could say or relics that you could carry, or indeed that going to Mass on any particular day would stop you dying suddenly on that day. So they were clearly worried about dying in an accident when they hadn't had time to compose themselves, particularly because the classic deathbed, people are meant not only to make their peace with God, but also to make their peace with their neighbours and call in people to whom they owed debts or against whom they had grudges or whatever in an ideal world, and put things straight with them. So just being run over by a cart or kicked by a horse or falling into a river and drowning was something that worried people in a broader sense, not just in the sense that, that they would die doing that rather than dying doing something else. On the other hand, clearly people were very worried about diseases of all sorts and sought all sorts of remedies to deal with them. And indeed, the government started to try to, for example, introduce quarantine to deal with plague outbreaks in the 16th century in a way that they hadn't done before. So I think people are worried about both the background disease kind of deaths and, of course, background starvation kind of deaths at times when harvests were bad. Again, 16th century governments were the first to start to intervene systematically in the grain market to try to bring grain onto the market at affordable prices in years of bad harvest so that people wouldn't starve. And it looks as though the Lake District, which is an area with very poor communications to the rest of the country in this period, the Lake District in the late 16th and early 17th century was more or less the last place in England where people died in large numbers in famines. People would be weakened or become ill or so, and so on in famines, but it looks as though there wasn't that much death from starvation in 16th century England. But even so, it's something people would have worried about. It's interesting, of course, that accidents are something that again, people could take measures against, and there are some forms of health and safety advice in 16th century England. We've been using a book by Thomas Tusser, who's an agricultural author, wrote a book called 500 Points of Good Husbandry, which is advice for farmers. And some of that has advice about, for example, keeping your rat poison in a very safe place, because otherwise there's a danger that it will poison your family members. And we have got people who accidentally eat rat poison and die from that. Or he also gives people advice that if they're trying to control birds that are attacking their crops or their livestock by going up in a tree to destroy a bird's nest, then they should climb very carefully. And we've got numbers of people who fall out of trees after climbing up them in the attempt to destroy bird's nests. So there clearly was discussion in the 16th century about how you avoided accidents, but equally things always go wrong sooner or later. The other thing, of course, is that although it's hard to say absolutely whether people are more or less likely to die in accidents then than they are now, it's very interesting to see what the proportions of accidents are that are different. So drowning, in 2010, drowning accounted for maybe 2% of accidental deaths in Britain. In the 16th century, it's somewhere between 40 and 50%. So the sorts of hazards that people are exposed to are very different. Similarly, horses are a much bigger threat in the 16th century. And other things are much less of a threat. We have a few people, but not very many people, who die falling downstairs, whereas now that's quite a common injury, because in the 16th century, most houses are only one or at most two stories, and most of the population is rather younger. So the classic accidents now of older people tripping and falling downstairs are just not so likely to happen in the 16th century.
And what's the next stage of your research project now?
So the next stage is that we're moving on to the 1590s, and the idea being that having looked at the 1550s in detail, we can then look at the 1590s and see what sorts of comparisons we can make about change over time. In the end, we're aiming to work right through all the 16th century accidental death material. It's thinner at the start of the century, so we won't have quite so many records from the first two or three decades of the century. Then the numbers are pretty constant from the 1540s, 1550s onwards. And as we go along, the aim is to look at different aspects of life. So we've been looking recently at work, agricultural work, and also industrial work, and how it's different in different parts of the country, different at different times of year. October, for example, was the classic time for falling out of trees, trying to knock acorns down to fatten pigs, because that was the season for fattening up pigs on ripe acorns before you slaughtered them, because there wasn't enough food to keep them going over the winter. So that's an area we'll look at. What we're aiming to do is to, over the 4 years, to look at as many different areas of 16th century life as we can through these accidents, and then pull it all together at the end into a book that works out what we can and can't find out about 16th century life from looking at all these accidental death reports.
Well, it sounds like really fascinating research, but do you ever find it a bit too bleak?
Well, it's true that because every document that we're looking at is about somebody getting killed in an unexpected way, you do have to stop and remind yourself that these are tragic events. Some of them, partly because they're very common accidents at the time, people walking along next to water and falling in, start to become rather predictable and ordinary. Others of them, when you read about them for the first time, are really upsetting. We've got several with groups of young people washing sheep together in fast-flowing rivers before the sheep are sheared, and one person gets knocked over and gets into trouble in the water, and then one after another, all the others go in to try and help them. And that's one of those situations that's quite painful to think your way into. So they are distressing, and obviously the ones with small children in are particularly distressing. On the other hand, we do find ourselves, particularly when we put them all together or when we come across particularly unusual or interesting ones, saying, well, in the end, it's a tragedy. These people died. After all, they might well have died of the plague the next year. And what we find out about their lives from the things that happened to them do give us the chance in some ways to put them back into history and to take people who were very ordinary people even in the 16th century and learn very interesting things about their lives and the lives of other people in the 16th century from the necessarily tragic events that happened to them.
That was Stephen Gunn of Merton College, Oxford. His research has been undertaken together with colleague Tomasz Grymalski of Wolfson College, Oxford. You can read their article in the Christmas issue of BBC History magazine, which is still available as a back issue, as well as on the iPad. Before our next interview, I'd like to briefly mention an exciting new app that we've launched for the iPad. The Second World War Story is an interactive guide to the greatest conflict in human history. It's packed with expert analysis, stunning images, and video footage. You can find the Second World War Story at the App Store now. Anglo-Saxon England is often thought of as an idyllic land of rural peace and harmony. Yet, as Ryan Lavelle of the University of Winchester tells section editor Matt Elton, the truth was often far less bucolic.
There's often quite a nostalgic view of the Anglo-Saxon period. Is this view fairly far wide of the mark?
There is a nostalgic view of the Anglo-Saxon period, yes, and it's rather misjudging the period to think of it in this kind of rosy glow of sweet meadows and babbling brooks and people sort of leading this sort of idyllic pastoral life. It's quite a long way far of the mark to assume that life is like that. I'm sure there were, you know, quite pleasant summers in Anglo-Saxon England, just as occasionally we get them today. But the notion of a kind of rural idyll, I think, has its roots in really in a sort of not just a post-industrial but a kind of industrial as part of the results of the process of industrialization and the sort of Victorian responses to industrialization, looking back to ideas of a lost Eden. I think I get the sense that starts to become really predominant in popular culture in the 19th century, and so, you know, when we romanticize the Anglo-Saxon period, as often happens, we're in fact sort of we're picking up a Victorian idea in many ways, and an early modern idea of a kind of romanticized Anglo-Saxon past. So yes, it is pretty wide of the mark.
Okay, fantastic. So, I mean, talking about what life was actually like in the period, was there much of a class system?
Well, yes, yeah. I mean, it's not a society of equals. It's and I think that's one of the historiographical myths of the Anglo-Saxon period. So that's one of the sort of myths that comes about through the writing of history about the period, is that we've got this kind of sense of the Anglo-Saxons waddling about, as Thomas Carlyle put it, waddling about in pot-bellied equanimity. So there's the sort of groups wandering around in quite an egalitarian, equal society, and that's one of the myths, and that myth can really be dispelled by looking at, say, an Anglo-Saxon charter, where a document which would record the granting of land, for example, where the people in the society, the people at the top of society are quite rigidly defined according to their offices. They're ranked in order of seniority. So even at the top, there's a kind of class system. And then there is a very large, evidently a very large peasant class, some free, and some of those, the members of that class, unfree as well. And there is a kind of sense of a rigid delineation between the rulers and the ruled in what could be called class terms, certainly.
So how were these classes split up?
So within social classes, of course, to say classes is a bit of a modern misnomer in some ways. Classes is to say a social class exists in the Anglo-Saxon period is perhaps to put a sort of modern focus on it. But we can say classes. Maybe in the medieval period the word order might be used for a group of people. But I mean, in terms of class divisions within a sort of social class, there are people of different social distinctions who do particular tasks, who do particular jobs on the land. There are particular peasants, in fact, the yabur class, who seem to have been increasingly predominant in estates, in rural estates, who are linked to particular pieces of land, particular areas of land where they wouldn't in fact be able to move from those estates, in fact, or they may have the rights to move from those areas of land, but in effect, if they did move away, they'd lose everything they put into that land in working on it. So there are particular gradations of social position within the rural peasant classes. So yes, I mean there are evidently groups of people within the classes. There were unfree peasants, entirely unfree peasants as well, who could be equated with slaves. In fact, I mean there does seem to be a distinctly large, a distinct slave class as well, who may well have been who were in many ways distinguished legally from the free peasantry. And whether there's a sort of middle class or not, I think is sort of open to debate. But there were certainly traders in Anglo-Saxon England too, and there's evidence that people tried to move between classes according to whether or not they gained wealth, and that there are particular sort of ceilings to social mobility at points as well.
Okay, I mean, talking about the very highest orders, I suppose, were there certain things that enabled you to become a member of those top orders?
The ownership of lands is the main thing. So to own 5 hides of land is seen as the qualifying ownership, the qualifying issue for people to be a member of the Thanely class in the 11th century. And in fact, Wulfstan, the Archbishop of York, complained that that people were attempting to gain this Thanely position without having the necessary land. So evidently, you know, maybe there were some people who were getting through this qualifying position without what was required. But basically, there do seem to have been particular material expectations for these people. So you've got that, and then there are also other things that they might be required to have: their own residence with their own tower and their own bell tower on it, and their own hall within that residence. So these are, you know, these are quite major qualifying attributes. These are the sorts of things that you would associate with a knightly class in later centuries. In fact, is very similar to the continental knightly class, and so that's the sort of thing that defines you as being of aristocratic status in the Anglo-Saxon period. And as you move higher into the nobility, as you start to see the sort of super magnates, one defining feature seems to be being linked to the royal family. So through marriage or through blood or perhaps by both, in fact, you know, being related to the royal family was an important thing. So in fact, this sort of super kin group, this sort of class of super magnates of late Anglo-Saxon England, the very wealthy ealdormen and later earls were related to the royal family by some very close networks. So these are things that are perhaps less legally defining features than things which sort of come out of belonging to a powerful controlling ruling class in the period.
Sure. So, I mean, it sounds quite difficult to become a high-ranked kind of social member. I mean, how much sociability was there in the period?
I think social mobility is limited. There are debates as to how easy it was to move up through far more opaque than glass ceilings in the period. They were very, very defined glass ceilings between these different areas of status, and so there are these kind of debates relating to these legal texts largely from the 11th century about where people might belong, and there have been arguments that people could move up between those classes, but I think you would have to do particularly well in order to move from being, say, a free peasant who had acquired a certain amount of land and acquired more land and acquired more wealth as a result of this, and been a successful successful farmer in effect. There were still limits as to how far they could move up to the Thanely class. I think the requirement is quite a socially exclusive requirement. This is an exclusive club, the Thanely class in late Anglo-Saxon England. And so social mobility, I think, in that respect is limited. But evidently people were able to prosper, you know, so It was possible to do well. It was evidently possible to flourish for one's estates to flourish, and say even for a free peasant to acquire more land and the means of greater production. I mean, this is a period, the period of the 8th, 9th, 10th centuries are periods of land clearance where more land is coming under production, and it's possible to flourish in that way. It's possible because of the opening of new markets as well in the many towns that are founded in England in the 9th and 10th centuries and indeed the 11th centuries. So it was possible to gain wealth, to perhaps even gain coins as well as a result of trading in markets in the period too. So the possibilities of social mobility in terms of material wealth were evidently present. So I don't think we should really assume that everybody is absolutely bolted down to their to states of penury and poverty. But nonetheless, there are evident, you know, there are evident aims of stopping people who do particularly well to climb the social ladder too quickly.
Okay, so turning to the other end of the spectrum, I suppose, what would day-to-day life have been like for the poorest members of society?
It's difficult to know, but it's for the poorest members of society who do the most difficult jobs. I mean, it's a hard life. I think it's a difficult life. It's a situation where there's where agricultural work has to be done in the daylight hours that are available. In wintertime, of course, there's less work to be done because there's less daylight in which to do it, fewer tasks are to be done in winter, but there are still tasks to be done, such as mending fences and still ensuring that that land is properly maintained. There's a lot of agricultural tasks that are necessary in Anglo-Saxon England, just as in any pre-industrial society where people live on the land, and for the poorest members of society, people live in a state where the possibility of gaining a sort of greater surplus of food, of things to eat, of ways to sustain your family are limited. And effectively it's a subsistence economy where people are living in that manner. So in terms of the poorest in society, the poorest tend to be the people who are socially unfree, are quite possibly slaves, and have to do the dirtier jobs around the Anglo-Saxon farm. They have to do the ploughing, the hard work. There is a 10th century text which records the words of a ploughman, the sort of imagined words of a ploughman, who says, he is asked, is it hard work? And he says, it is hard work because I am not free. I have to rise early in the morning to do this work. And you get the sense of the toil, boring, the endless toil, I think, is the other part of it. I mean, to keep ploughing fields is a tremendous, you know, using oxen, using wooden ploughs and the wooden ploughshares is tremendously difficult work. It's hard work, and it's also tiring work as well. So when you've got those tasks necessary, you've got the tasks of looking after animals as well, and ensuring that the property is maintained, usually not your own property as well. The poorest members of society might have land that they're cultivating for themselves, but they're also cultivating land for landlords, manorial landlords as well. So they're also doing the work for those landlords. So it doesn't mean to say that there's no possibility for thinking beyond the sort of manual tasks, but as the literature of the Anglo-Saxons has riddles, for example, which are the kind of literary entertainment, evidently the literary entertainment of the working man and woman, but the idea that you would have tremendous amounts of free time in which to enjoy it, I'm not convinced that there would be huge amounts of free time in later, certainly not in later Anglo-Saxon society, for the for the poorest members of society, at least for those who were working on other people's land or are socially unfree.
Okay, thank you. And moving on to another fairly major social group, how do you think women would have fared during the period?
Well, I think the thing is, I've been talking about people of these different classes, and women belong to these different social classes as well. So there were female slaves, there were female members of the churlish class, there were female yobours, so the kind of free peasantry, and there were women nobles, so women could be members of the nobility, to the extent actually that there are Anglo-Saxon wills of women who record the render of what's known as a heriot payment, a rendering of weapons is legally what's meant by a heriot. So you render weapons to your lord so that you might have the right to make a will. And it's interesting that, well, there are a number of wills of Anglo-Saxon women, but it's interesting that there are some which refer to the rendering of weapons to a lord in order that they might be able to make their will, just as an Anglo-Saxon male thane would do. So there's a kind of equality of status in terms of legal terms of status in some ways for women, but on the other hand, women's position depended upon their father, it depended on their husband, it depended on their brother, there's a number mentioning the wills of Anglo-Saxon noble women, it's very interesting how many of the wills indicate the interest of the male members of the families in those wills. So whereas these women may not have felt like they were being oppressed by the members of their families when they were granting lands to sons and brothers and whatever, there's a kind of expectation. I think there's a very strong social expectation that they do the right thing for their family, a kind of social, a family corporate identity, if you like, a kind of family identity that women have to abide by.
That was Ryan Lavelle of the University of Winchester. He wrote a piece for our Christmas issue, which, as I mentioned earlier, can still be ordered as a back issue and purchased for the iPad. And that is about all for this episode. Why not tell us what you thought of it by getting in touch on email, podcast@historyextra.com, on Twitter @HistoryExtra, or on Facebook /HistoryExtra. Do join us next week when we'll be talking about the Knights Templar, among other things. And in the meantime, you can keep an eye on what we're up to via our website, historyextra.com. There you'll find quizzes, blogs, book reviews, TV previews, and much, much more. Thanks a lot for listening. The History Extra podcast was recorded in Bristol and produced by Jack Fletcher.